This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please contact LibriVox.org. Recorded by Peter Yearsley. Present at a Hanging and Other Ghost Stories by Ambrose Bierce. The Ways of Ghosts. My peculiar relation to the writer of the following narratives is such that I must ask the reader to overlook the absence of explanation as to how they came into my possession. Withal, my knowledge of him is so meagre that I should rather not undertake to say if he were himself persuaded of the truth of what he relates. Certainly, such inquiries as I have thought it worthwhile to set about have not in every instance tended to confirmation of the statements made. Yet his style, for the most part devoid alike of artifice and art, almost baldly simple and direct, seems hardly compatible with the disingenuousness of a merely literary intention. One would call it the manner of one more concerned for the fruits of research than for the flowers of expression. In transcribing his notes and fortifying their claim to attention by giving them something of an orderly arrangement, I have conscientiously refrained from embellishing them with such small ornaments of diction as I may have felt myself able to bestow, which would not only have been impertinent, even if pleasing, but would have given me a somewhat closer relation to the work than I should care to have and to avow. Ambrose Bierce. The Ways of Ghosts, Present at a Hanging. An old man named Daniel Baker, living near Lebanon, Iowa, was suspected by his neighbors of having murdered a peddler who had obtained permission to pass the night at his house. This was in 1853, when peddling was more common in the western country than it is now, and was attended with considerable danger. The peddler with his pack traversed the country by all manner of lonely roads, and was compelled to rely upon the country people for hospitality. This brought him into relation with queer characters, some of whom were not altogether scrupulous in their methods of making a living, murder being an acceptable means to that end. It occasionally occurred that a peddler with diminished pack and swollen purse would be traced to the lonely dwelling of some rough character and never could be traced beyond. This was so in the case of Old Man Baker, as he was always called. Such names are given in the western settlements only to elderly persons who are not esteemed. To the general disrepute of social unworth is affixed the special reproach of age. A peddler came to his house, and none went away. That is all that anybody knew. 7 years later, the Reverend Mr. Cummings, a Baptist minister well known in that part of the country, was driving by Baker's farm one night. It was not very dark. There was a bit of moon somewhere above the light veil of mist that lay along the earth. Mr. Cummings, who was at all times a cheerful person, was whistling a tune, which he would occasionally interrupt to speak a word of friendly encouragement to his horse. As he came to a little bridge across a dry ravine, he saw the figure of a man standing upon it, clearly outlined against the grey background of a misty forest. The man had something strapped on his back and carried a heavy stick, obviously an itinerant peddler. His attitude had in it a suggestion of abstraction, like that of a sleepwalker. Mr. Cummings reined in his horse when he arrived in front of him, gave him a pleasant salutation, and invited him to a seat in the vehicle. "If you're going my way," he added. The man raised his head, looked him full in the face, but neither answered nor made any further movement. The minister, with good-natured persistence, repeated his invitation. At this, the man threw his right hand forward from his side and pointed downward as he stood on the extreme edge of the bridge. Mr. Cummings looked past him over into the ravine, saw nothing unusual, and withdrew his eyes to address the man again. He had disappeared. The horse, which all this time had been uncommonly restless, gave at the same moment a snort of terror and started to run away. Before he had regained control of the animal, the minister was at the crest of the hill, 100 yards along. He looked back and saw the figure again, at the same place and in the same attitude as when he had first observed it. Then, for the first time, he was conscious of a sense of the supernatural, and drove home as rapidly as his willing horse would go. On arriving at home, he related his adventure to his family, and early the next morning, accompanied by two neighbors, John White Corwell and Abner Razor, returned to the spot. They found the body of Old Man Baker hanging by the neck from one of the beams of the bridge, immediately beneath the spot where the apparition had stood. A thick coating of dust, slightly dampened by the mist, covered the floor of the bridge, but the only footprints were those of Mr. Cummings's horse. In taking down the body, the men disturbed the loose, friable earth of the slope below it, disclosing human bones already nearly uncovered by the action of water and frost. They were identified as those of the lost peddler. At the double inquest, the coroner's jury found that Daniel Baker died by his own hand while suffering from temporary insanity, and that Samuel Moritz was murdered by some person or persons to the jury unknown. A Cold Greeting. This is a story told by the late Benson Foley of San Francisco. In the summer of 1881, I met a man named James H. Conway, a resident of Franklin, Tennessee. He was visiting San Francisco for his health, deluded man, and brought me a note of introduction from Mr. Lawrence Barting. I had known Barting as a captain in the Federal Army during the Civil War. At its close, he had settled in Franklin, and in time became, I had reason to think, somewhat prominent as a lawyer. Barting had always seemed to me an honourable and truthful man, and the warm friendship which he expressed in his note for Mr. Conway was, to me, sufficient evidence that the latter was in every way worthy of my confidence and esteem. At dinner one day, Conway told me that it had been solemnly agreed between him and Barting that the one who died first should, if possible, communicate with the other from beyond the grave, in some unmistakable way, just how they had left. Wisely, it seemed to me, to be decided by the deceased, according to the opportunities that his altered circumstances might present. A few weeks after the conversation in which Mr. Conway spoke of this agreement, I met him one day, walking slowly down Montgomery Street, apparently, from his abstracted air, in deep thought. He greeted me coldly, with merely a movement of the head, and passed on, leaving me standing on the walk, with half-proffered hand, surprised, and naturally somewhat piqued. The next day I met him again, in the office of the Palace Hotel, and, seeing him about to repeat the disagreeable performance of the day before, intercepted him in a doorway, with a friendly salutation, and bluntly requested an explanation of his altered manner. He hesitated a moment, then, looking me frankly in the eyes, said, "I do not think, Mr. Foley, that I have any longer a claim to your friendship, since Mr. Barton appears to have withdrawn his own from me. For what reason, I protest, I do not know. If he has not already informed you, he probably will do so." "But," I replied, "I have not heard from Mr. Barton." "Heard from him?" he repeated with apparent surprise. "Why, he is here. I met him yesterday, 10 minutes before meeting you. I gave you exactly the same greeting that he gave me. I met him again not a quarter of an hour ago, and his manner was precisely the same. He merely bowed and passed on. I shall not forget your civility to me, Good morning, or, as it may please you, farewell. All this seemed to me singularly considerate and delicate behaviour on the part of Mr. Conway. As dramatic situations and literary effects are foreign to my purpose, I'll explain at once that Mr. Barting was dead. He had died in Nashville 4 days before this conversation. Calling on Mr. Conway, I apprised him of our friend's death, showing him the letters announcing it. He was visibly affected in a way that forbade me to entertain a doubt of his sincerity. "It seems incredible," he said, after a period of reflection. "I suppose I must have mistaken another man for Barting, and that man's cold greeting was merely a stranger's civil acknowledgment of my own. I remember, indeed, that he lacked Barting's moustache." "Doubtless it was another man," I assented, and the subject was never afterwards mentioned between us. But I had in my pocket a photograph of Barting, which had been enclosed in the letter from his widow. It had been taken a week before his death, and was without a moustache. A wireless message. In the summer of 1896, Mr. William Holt, a wealthy manufacturer of Chicago, was living temporarily in a little town of central New York, the name of which the writer's memory has not retained. Mr. Holt had had trouble with his wife, from whom he had parted a year before. Whether the trouble was anything more serious than incompatibility of temper, he is probably the only living person that knows. He is not addicted to the vice of confidences. Yet he has related the incident herein set down to at least one person without exacting a pledge of secrecy. He is now living in Europe. One evening, he had left the house of a brother whom he was visiting for a stroll in the country. It may be assumed, whatever the value of the assumption in connection with what is said to have occurred, that his mind was occupied with reflections on his domestic infelicities and the distressing changes that they had wrought in his life. Whatever may have been his thoughts, they so possessed him that he observed neither the lapse of time nor whither his feet were carrying him. He knew only that he had passed far beyond the town limits and was traversing a lonely region by a road that bore no resemblance to the one by which he had left the village. In brief, he was lost. Realizing his mischance, he smiled. Central New York is not a region of perils, nor does one long remain lost in it. He turned about and went back the way that he had come. Before he had gone far, he observed that the landscape was growing more distinct, was brightening. Everything was suffused with a soft red glow in which he saw his shadow projected in the road before him. "The moon is rising," he said to himself. Then he remembered that it was about the time of the new moon, and if that tricksy orb was in one of its stages of visibility, it had set long before. He stopped and faced about, seeking the source of the rapidly broadening light. As he did so, his shadow turned and lay along the road in front of him, as before. The light still came from behind him. That was surprising. He could not understand. Again he turned, and again, facing successively to every point of the horizon. Always the shadow was before, always the light behind, a still and awful red. Holt was astonished. Dumbfounded is the word that he used in telling it, yet seems to have retained a certain intelligent curiosity. To test the intensity of the light, whose nature and cause he could not determine, he took out his watch to see if he could make out the figures on the dial. They were plainly visible, and the hands indicated the hour of 11:25. At that moment, the mysterious illumination suddenly flared to an intense and almost blinding splendor, flushing the entire sky, extinguishing the stars, and throwing the monstrous shadow of himself athwart the landscape. In that unearthly illumination, he saw near him, but apparently in the air at a considerable elevation, the figure of his wife, clad in her night clothing and holding to her breast the figure of his child. Her eyes were fixed upon his with an expression which he afterwards professed himself unable to name or describe, further than that it was not of this life. The flare was momentary, followed by black darkness, in which, however, the apparition still showed white and motionless. Then, by insensible degrees, it faded and vanished, like a bright image on the retina after the closing of the eyes. A peculiarity of the apparition, hardly noted at the time, but afterwards recalled, was that it showed only the upper half of the woman's figure. Nothing was seen below the waist. The sudden darkness was comparative, not absolute, for gradually all objects of his environment became again visible. In the dawn of the morning, Holt found himself entering the village at a point opposite to that at which he had left it. He soon arrived at the house of his brother, who hardly knew him. He was wide-eyed, haggard, and grey as a rat. Almost incoherently, he related his night's experience. "Go to bed, my poor fellow," said his brother, "and wait. We shall hear more of this." An hour later came the predestined telegram. Holt's dwelling, in one of the suburbs of Chicago, had been destroyed by fire. Her escape cut off by the flames, his wife had appeared at an upper window, her child in her arms. There she had stood, motionless, apparently dazed. Just as the fireman had arrived with a ladder, the floor had given way, and she was seen no more. The moment of this culminating horror was 11:25 standard time. An arrest. Having murdered his brother-in-law, Orrin Brower of Kentucky was a fugitive from justice. From the county jail where he had been confined to await his trial, he had escaped by knocking down his jailer with an iron bar, robbing him of his keys, and, opening the outer door, walking out into the night. The jailer, being unarmed, Brower got no weapon with which to defend his recovered liberty. As soon as he was out of the town, he had the folly to enter a forest. This was many years ago, when that region was wilder than it is now. The night was pretty dark, with neither moon nor stars visible, and as Brower himself had never dwelt thereabout, and knew nothing of the lay of the land, he was naturally not long in losing himself. He could not have said if he were getting farther away from the town or going back to it, a most important matter to Orrin Brower. He knew that in either case, a posse of citizens with a pack of bloodhounds would soon be on his track, and his chance of escape was very slender, but he did not wish to assist in his own pursuit. Even an added hour of freedom was worth having. Suddenly, he emerged from the forest into an old road, and there before him saw, indistinctly, the figure of a man motionless in the gloom. It was too late to retreat. The fugitive felt that, at the first movement back toward the wood, he would be, as he afterwards explained, filled with buckshot. So the two stood there like trees. Brower, nearly suffocated by the activity of his own heart, the emotions of the other are not recorded. A moment later, it may have been an hour, the moon sailed into a patch of unclouded sky, and the hunted man saw that visible embodiment of law lift an arm and point significantly toward and beyond him. He understood. Turning his back to his captor, he walked submissively away in the direction indicated, looking to neither the right nor the left, hardly daring to breathe, his head and back actually aching with a prophecy of buckshot. Brower was as courageous a criminal as ever lived to be hanged. That was shown by the conditions of awful personal peril in which he had coolly killed his brother-in-law. It is needless to relate them here. They came out at his trial, and the revelation of his calmness in confronting them came near to saving his neck. But what would you have? When a brave man is beaten, he submits. So they pursued their journey jailward along the old road through the woods. Only once did Brower venture a turn of the head. Just once, when he was in deep shadow and he knew that the other was in moonlight, he looked backward. His captor was Burton Duff, the jailer, as white as death and bearing upon his brow the livid mark of the iron bar. Orrin Brower had no further curiosity. Eventually, they entered the town, which was all alight, but deserted. Only the women and children remained, and they were off the streets. Straight toward the jail, the criminal held his way. Straight up to the main entrance he walked, laid his hand upon the knob of the heavy iron door, pushed it open without command, entered, and found himself in the presence of a half-dozen armed men. Then he turned. Nobody else entered. On a table in the corridor lay the dead body of Burton Duff. End of Present at a Hanging, The Ways of Ghosts.